I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the beginning of the week, fellow conspiracy realist, which means it is time for some strange news. In this case, some very strange news. Today, we are exploring brutal corporate scandals. I think it goes deeper than just a corporate scandal, I would say. We're exploring a literal plague, like something that would not be out of place in the Old Testament. And we are questioning the fundamental nature of how we experience time. We being the human species. This is a funny one, actually, guys. It reminds me, not spoiling the story too much, Have you guys ever heard of the Russian drinking game Submarine? Have we ever talked about that?
No. Okay. Not to my knowledge.
So in Russia, for a long time, there's been this drinking game called Submarine. And I don't know if you can even call it a game. Russian speakers or people familiar with this, please write in and explain to us what is defined as winning this game, because I am at a loss to understand it.
It sounds like there's no winning this game.
It feels okay. Here's what happens. So if you want to play Submarine, you get together with a crew of like-minded colleagues. You find an apartment for this purpose. You black out all of the windows of the apartment. You get rid of all the clocks, anything that can help you interact with the outside world or let you know what's going on. And you take a ton of alcohol in there and you just drink and drink and drink in the darkness. And the game ends when you run out of booze. What?
Like, who, seems dangerous,
right?
It's on multiple levels.
Yeah, it doesn't. I think everybody has a close crew of friends, but I've never been hanging out with anybody I know and thought, you know, it'd be awesome if we were locked in the dark in an apartment and just tried to give ourselves alcohol poisoning. But
yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, what if you did it instead in a cave?
Segue. I like it. That's okay. Let's go there first. So this is a weird one. Some of our friends, our fellow listeners on Here's Where It Gets Crazy are also aware of this. It caught my eye as well. Someone is taking the booze out of the submarine concept, and they are launching an experiment, which is going on as we record today, to understand more about the fundamentals of how human beings perceive time. This is fascinating because time is something, and we've talked about this before, but time is something that we seem to experience, right, in a linear fashion, mostly. But if you drill down into the way the human brain works and you drill down into the ways different cultures encounter and think about time, then you find the rules of the game get a little fuzzy at the edges. Like if you have ever spent an extended amount of time, there we are. If you ever spent an extended amount of time, like out in the woods or somewhere where your body and your mind are marking the passage of seconds and hours and days just based on the patterns of the sun, the stars, and the moon, then you'll notice that pretty quickly your body clock will start to obey something different from the 24-hour period that most societies, the vast majority of societies, practice, right? Like, has this ever happened to you guys? Have you ever been away from the human concept of time as it's marked and then noticed your sleep patterns changing, noticed your waking activity peaks moving to different times?
Well, and I think this is a hot issue for a lot of people, but daylight savings times I always forget if there's an S there or not, always messes me up. Just that 1 hour, it changes my whole perception of time for a couple of days. And if something as simple as, like, you know, pushing the clock forward or back an hour can do that, obviously it is kind of a psychological construct. But yeah, no, I mean, and it also depends. I mean, COVID did it too, I think, for a lot of us, when you didn't have as many things to mark the time with, or a commute, for example, or a time that you had to show up in person and be a place. I think there was, the joke, it became a cliche, or what even is time during this COVID, situation?
Yeah, I would just say the internal clock of when the sun is supposed to appear and when it's supposed to go away, really, like, having that change arbitrarily by the humans deciding that it's an hour earlier or later really does something internally to my biology. Mm-hmm. I can say that for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I love pointing out the social structure aspect of this, because time zones, which largely come about due to the railroad industry, time zones have in some cases become a tool of control. Like, the way time zones work in China is very different, to put it simply, very different from the way time zones work in the US. And there are also, historical accounts of calendrical changes, where, like, populations of a certain town felt their days were quote unquote stolen from them. And although that might sound a little bit absurd or ridiculous when we look back with the benefit of retrospect, the point is absolutely true. It feels like someone is stealing an hour from your life when everybody has to jump ahead an hour. And, it feels a little bit like time travel when you get that hour back later. So we do know that there are various, maybe a good way to describe them is various kinds of time, like Einstein's famous quote about relativity, attributed to Einstein. This brings us to a very interesting experiment in France. There are 15 people, they're volunteers. They have been sealed in a dark cave. It's going to run for 40 days. They have no access to natural light. They have no ability to tell time. So they are living a troglodytic existence. They have no source of light at all. No phones, no watches. The only way that they will be able to have some sort of routine of wake and sleep is going to be based on their own body rhythms and based on their own reactions to the other 14 people. in their cohort. This is massively disorienting, you know, like just like we talk about all the time when we record. Sometimes we'll be in the booth here and we'll start, you know, like matinee movie rules, right? Start around 4:30 or something, and then we'll leave our respective areas and we'll see that it's dark. That's disorienting. Imagine that for 40 days, right?
Yeah, this is okay. Let me just wrap my head around this. There's no light in that cave, or are they using light from out? There's no sunlight either.
The only source of light, from what I understand, is through this pedal-driven dynamo that's going to be creating electricity. So there are people just pedaling in the dark. Like, hey, I need to see something. Someone, get on the bike.
Wow. So they have to work together where one individual has to be on the bike and then the rest of the group can get something done. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the volunteer, okay. The volunteers range in age from 27 to 50. They have different walks of life, different jobs, and they're all fitted with these sensors that scientists outside the cave can use to measure their body's response to this incredibly unnatural situation. According to neuroscientist Professor Etienne Copeland, this experiment is a world first. Anything else like this, like there have been other isolation experiments, right? Biosphere, for instance, which inspired a fantastic Pauly Shore film. I'm kidding. Was it Pauly Shore?
Was it Biodome?
Oh, yeah, Biodome. Of course.
I was joking. It was a joke. Biodome, yeah. It was one of the first appearances on the big screen of Tenacious D as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Did not know that. Mm-hmm. If everything goes according to plan, this team of 15 will leave this cave on April 22nd. So not a super long time for us, but who knows how much time, quote unquote, time it is for them.
Oh, yeah. And when they emerge, will they ever be the same again? That's my question.
That's a great question. I mean, this also, you know, arguably, even though these folks are volunteers, this could be seen as skirting the limits of ethics as we understand them for human experimentation. Of course, they are being continually monitored, so we would assume that if someone has a grievous injury or a really bad reaction, the scientists will pull them out. But we don't know for sure just because it's never been done. If you want to learn more about this, you can go to deeptime.fr. You can pick a couple of different languages to learn more about this. For the point of ethics, you know, this could also be seen as similar to the Stanford Prison experiment. This could also be seen as similar to the Biosphere 2 specifically. Biosphere 2 is a bit of a cautionary tale because that experiment had to end when the oxygen inside the people container, the biodome, hit dangerous levels, and everyone involved, all eight people, nearly starved to death. What does this tell us? Why are we doing this weird, cool, fascinating thing? Well, in the future, if humanity does not self-destruct, there are going to be increasing cases of long-term isolation. They're kind of similar to this, maybe not in the fact that they're in a cave, but imagine you're in space. You are escaping the star that has ruled your life for so very long. Astronaut time is a thing, and it's going to be an increasingly complicated thing as humanity travels, humanity and all the paraphernalia of humanity, travel deeper into the ink that surrounds Earth. I want to know if you guys would do it.
No. That's a hard pass for me.
Sure. Yeah, I would do this. Mm-hmm. For sure, I would do this.
You're so first, game, Matt. Well, I respect that.
Well, caves are the best. And if you don't believe that and you don't if you're not fully on board with caves, then let's have a conversation and I will change your mind.
I'm in that caversation.
Caves have a bad rap though, Matt. You think about, you know, cave collapses, you know, creepy things live in caves. Like where are you getting all this positive cave energy from?
Look, mines collapse, and that's because humans are trying to get stuff out of the holes in the earth that are there. Caves don't collapse that often, especially if you take care to maintain them and you're aware you know, that it's an important structure. It's cool. Mm. There's a whole ecosystem that's living down there. The other thing is you're in the dark. You don't have a lot of tools. You've got that bike that can provide you with much needed light. There's not much to do. I'm wondering what I would get up to besides having philosophical conversations with my cohort.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I would 100% do this by myself. I don't know if I would want to do it with 14 other people or with anybody else, really. Just leave me down there with the creepy stuff that only exists in that ecosystem. You might be startled if you are not too familiar with caves and caverns. You might be startled to learn just how many are still unexplored. There's a lot of stuff going on under the surface there. The point about unique ecosystems is also fascinating. I'm a big fan of caves. Years ago, we all watched, oh gosh, what was it? Planet Earth? Was that the
Love
name
it.
Of it?
Or so Life? Good.
They have these two great episodes. It's stereotypical of me, but the two great episodes that I really enjoyed were the ones about the depths of the ocean, the abyssal plain, and the ones about caverns and cave ecosystems, because the fact of the matter is everything basically runs on the energy from the sun. We talked about it in that episode where we ruined sunscreen. Caves kind of do a little bit, because creatures that travel to and from caves become the foundation of the cavern's ecosystem, specifically guano. Or that's like the most amazing stuff you see in a lot of caves is fueled by bat shit. And that's how the sun's energy gets in there. Without nerding out too much about caves, this experiment could also instruct us on how to handle the physiological and psychological changes humans experience in submarines. See, I brought it back. It wasn't just a Russian drinking game.
And, I knew you would, dude. I knew you would.
Oh, thanks, man. And with this in mind, you know, we want to hear from you, folks. Would you do this? Have you done something like this? What is the longest you have been away from the concept of human time as we understand it today? Last fun fact here. You know, to your point, Noel, I think a lot of people experienced some surprising shifts in their body cycles, circadian rhythms, the wake-sleep divide and ratio during COVID and during the pandemic. Before the advent of, you know, man-made light, electric light in particular, people did live and wake and sleep following the patterns of the sun, but people also tended to practice what today is called polyphasic sleep. So the idea of sleeping at an 8-hour stretch every 24 hours is like a good ballpark, but for many reasons, that doesn't work for everybody. And back in the day, before people had electric lights and clocks, a lot of folks would sleep in like 4-hour increments, and you'd wake up in the middle of the night. And that's when you get up to the weird stuff, you know, that's when you would do things you didn't want the other people in your village to know about. Go to your Sabbath, you know, cast some spells, sneak around and steal stuff. And there's a good argument to be made that the concept of human time as we understand it now will prove to be somewhat of a fad thousands and thousands of years in the future. Like if you live on Mars in the future, or if you live, you know, further out somewhere, then what good really is the calendar? What is your birthday at this point? When do you sleep when you're on a planet that doesn't have what you understand as a 24-hour day? And even further, and the current concept of time becomes even less relevant when we consider how complicated it is to measure time while you're traveling. Right. So let's say you're traveling from Earth to another solar system. For some reason, that was a good thing to do. The technology was there. Elon Musk really pitched you hard at Davos or something. So you're on board. What good is that clock? It'll count, you know, in your spaceship. You'll be like, OK, this is definitely 5:17 p.m. And it's definitely Tuesday here on our spaceship. but that will not mean a thing to the people of Earth or the people, whatever destination you're at. Shout out to Interstellar, the way they play with time.
Yes, exactly. It's very interesting to me because it feels like you'd only keep that around as a means of organizing everybody's actions and duties, right? That this is the only reason why you would maintain time on a spaceship. Make sure that everybody who needs to be in the engineering room is in the engineering room. Make sure that everyone gets to use the washing facilities separated out over time. You never really think about that when you're watching the folks on Star Trek just hanging out on the Enterprise doing stuff and everybody's synchronized. You never really think about it. And he always does mark a date and time. With that captain's log.
Star date, whatever. Is he using a real system there, or is that just kind of made up within the lore of the universe?
Well, you know, our human concept of time is relatively made up, you could argue. Yeah,
that's a really good point. And I was going to ask you before we moved on, if you think, you know, the biological stuff connected with the sun is more powerful, as powerful or less than the way we interact with other people and our routines. Because as we know, like so much of how we mark time has to do with how we interact with other people who are on the same time standard as we are. So if we say travel to the West Coast or, you know, overseas, it takes a few days to get up to speed with everyone else who's been existing on that, let's call it, you know, timetable or what have you. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think my mind would say, well, I mean, we know there's two aspects to it. We know there is a biological circadian rhythm thing that we all have to some extent. Whether or not we stick to it is kind of up to us. I know I certainly don't. I do not sleep enough. I know several of us on this show do the same.
Boom to sleep.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Oh, I know how you feel. Dude, come. Ooh. But I would say the most beneficial thing for time and timekeeping is to be in sync with one another. That's what I would say, Noel.
Yeah, time is, I'm tempted to agree. Time is the way humans understand it. Time is sort of a study of relationships, right? It's time exists in context to these tasks, these activities, these interactions. I would argue, you know, I'm freestyling here, but I would argue biological time or the timetable that Earth moves on without humans is more important because you could destroy all the clocks. Like you could destroy all the clocks and methods of measuring time the way we understand it, and you would still see biological time, which cannot be erased. Mm-hmm. And you would also, I mean, it'd be impossible to tell people not to, like, nobody build watches. You will be arrested if you have a sundial. That'll never work.
Totally.
And you can obviously tell time by just the passage of the sun. It's very easy. But
what if the sun, say, was like blacked out? What if the sun, I know that would, like, you know, for all intents and purposes, do a lot of harm, if not completely eradicate life on Earth. But what if we didn't have that and we lived in complete darkness except for artificial light and we had to just make benchmarks for ourselves? Like how do you think that would affect our minds? And when we have to just agree when to sleep? Because obviously the constant here is that we as human beings need to sleep at some point for some duration.
For now, yeah, you're right.
That's what the study's all about. That's the exciting thing going on here.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say we'll have to ask our fearless volunteers when they emerge, hopefully unscathed. This is going to be a very important question. We also want to hear from you folks. As always, do let us know, conspiracy@iheartradio.com, or give us a call, 1-833-STD-WYTK. What's the longest you've been away from human time? What did it do to you? Did you return to quote unquote normal? Or do you still sleep in like 4 2-hour increments spread across this somewhat arbitrary 24 hours? And I'm kidding. It's not arbitrary. There is a logic to it. But we are going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and we will return in time with another piece of strange news.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more strange news. This one's super strange. It's a very small story, but it's a small story that when multiplied and taken, you know, as a whole, it's a huge story. Am I being cryptic? Yes. It is about mice. Story about mice specifically in Australia. They have had some real biblical issues in Australia over the past few years. I mean, thank God they did such a good job of eradicating COVID super quickly. They seem to handle that really well, but then they obviously had all those terrible wildfires that were absolutely out of control. So they needed a break with the COVID thing. So that's fantastic. But now they have another one that's apparently been happening since October. And it is an essentially biblically proportioned plague of rodents. So why is this happening? I'm having a little bit of a hard time. I think they are having a hard time kind of perfectly nailing it down, but it has to do with a significant drought followed by a significant portion of rain, a rainy season that caused the mouse population to absolutely balloon. So essentially what's happening in the eastern part of Australia is they're just seeing, you know, thousands and thousands of mice. I saw one article that described it as like a sentient carpet of mice just moving as though it were one giant, you know, organism, like a hive mind. And this is happening specifically in New South Wales, Australia, southern Queensland, to the point where it's like people are just have all of these mice war stories. There was an account in The Guardian from Lisa Gore, who lives in the fantastically named town of Toowoomba. And she said that they have had to strip the fabric off of their furniture because it smells so bad. And when they did that, they actually found a nest of baby mice inside the stuffing. You know, local officials are recommending everyone plug up any entry or exit point to their houses, like in terms of like little, you know, holes or crevices with steel wool, because these mice have found ways to get in just about every way you can imagine. There's a video I have here from Matilda Bosley. It's a tweet, hashtag mouse plague, and it is absolute nightmare fuel. It's a shot of like one of those like office type vents, you know, the concentric squares with the slots in between. And you literally just see dozens of glinting eyes peering at you from out of the darkness. It is terrifying stuff. And apparently it's so bad in the same way that, you know, when COVID hit, we were having a hard time getting toilet paper and, sanitizer or, you know, like various cleaning supplies. Mouse traps are impossible to get in this part of Australia. And people are saying the smell is absolutely unbearable because these creatures just, you know, hide in the walls and then they just die. And he said it's so difficult to find all the bodies. There was one report from a store owner saying that they're catching between 400 and 500 in a week's time. And yeah, they literally, like this grocery store owner is saying, they have to get rid of 5 or 6 bins of groceries that they're having to throw out each week. And here's sort of an explanation that they think might be the case of why this explosion of the mouse population is happening. After quite a few years of severe drought, which is responsible for those wildfires in rural New South Wales and parts of Queensland, they had a bit of a rainy season that came and gave them a bumper crop. But with all of these new grains and vegetables came an explosion of this mouse population. They started noticing it as far back as October. And it was literally just, you know, waves and waves of these mice just taking over the land. And it's just gotten worse. There was one report from that same shop owner saying that this has so far cost his business $30,000. And in the same way that COVID ravaged so many small businesses, this is doing the same. And they're not sure how they're going to be able to continue with these kind of losses. And this is talking about after 3 months of this type of loss. And it's affecting people's daily lives too. They're getting into people's cars, you know, they're getting into people's homes and bedrooms and just like, you know, pooping everywhere and urinating everywhere. And like I said, dying in the walls. And you can Google this and you'll see just insane footage of, like I said, these things crawling into underneath the bottoms of cars, into refrigerators, industrial equipment, things like that. And it's, I just don't know, how do you even deal with that? There were some accounts from families saying, you know, oh, we're making it kind of a family affair. We've got the kids helping us create improvised traps out of wine bottles and buckets. There's an account of one family having drowned more than 300 mice in a bucket. Just to kind of make a dent. And yet with the absolute scale of this infestation, people don't think it's making a lick of difference.
Yeah, there's a really interesting thing going on here. For a very long time, the island/continent of Australia was a unique environment, right? Like if you look at just the preponderance of marsupials, animals that do not live anywhere else on the planet, you can see in very clear terms how the arrival of the outside world along with all its accoutrement and living creatures, how profoundly it affected the natural Australian environment. Plagues like this, or like this one in particular, I would argue, can occur because the mice are an invasive species, which means the ecosystem here has not evolved a response, right? Something to cut this off. And there was more food available. A bumper crop means an unusually large harvest, right? So this causes the mice to get to Meissen earlier in the season than usual. But one thing that I think we should point out, very important here, this is not the first mice plague rodeo for Australia.
That's right.
Mice came with Europeans in 1788, and they have had other plagues like ever since then, for the past few centuries. I think the biggest one, at least before this, was 1993. Like, the size of the plague is accelerating.
Exactly. 1984, I believe, was called like they had literally called it the mouse plague of 1984. I just never really thought of the term mouse plague before. But if that's something that's, you know, part of your world, I guess there's no better way of referring to it. But you're right, Ben. The government of New South Wales has been pretty unhelpful. And they, you know, citizens and store owners and small businesses, et cetera, have been asking to get relief in the form of whether it's pesticides or traps or more like analog kind of methods just to help them. They are not so far coming to anyone's aid. Apparently, they're very wary, according to this Guardian article, of spending what would essentially amount to tens of millions of dollars to try to wipe out this plague when they believe, and this is probably a more grounded in reality belief than that of, you know, COVID disappearing with a change of season. They believe that a cold snap or a heavy period of rain could wipe them out naturally. But, you know, that's a lot for people to bank on when they're literally, you know, having to kill hundreds of mice every day. And you have these pictures of like children, you know, like making improvised mouse traps and holding up these trophies almost. I just, you know, I had one situation. I lived in a house very temporarily. When I first moved to Atlanta, I was staying with a friend and we had mice in the walls and it smells atrocious. And we did have a situation where we had one in a trap that was still halfway alive. And we didn't know what to do. It's like you want to be humane and it's so inherently inhumane. But I imagine all that would go straight out the window when you're dealing with just literally thousands of them, you know?
Yeah, there are a couple problems here. The first one is you can't really do a Charlie Day thing where you just go down to the basement with a metal pole and you just bash some rodents, right? You can't just bash all the rodents. All right. And it's mostly because they're so small and so fast. There's so many of these and they're so tiny. You can't do that. What I'm proposing, I want to see what you guys think about this. Some kind of new vacuum system that incorporates cheese at the end of a large mouthed hose, that the cheese is affixed at the end of the large hose, and it's a silent vacuum. It has to be very quiet. Not silent, but just quiet. Quiet running. So the vacuum part is far away from where the actual hose end is. And then you just vacuum the mice into a container. It's safe, doesn't kill them. And then you can transport them to Mice Island. Now, we can either build Mice Island or we can, you know, decide this island is now Mice Island. Whichever way, it really doesn't matter. I feel like building Mice Island could be cooler, you know? Mm-hmm.
No, I'm like, my intense gaze is me like thinking through and wondering if we can get this locked down with like Dyson or something before someone scoops us.
There you go. Send them to Snake Island. That's coming directly from Doc Holliday.
I love it. I love it. Or even Cat Island, you know, Cat mm-hmm. Island would be cool. Mm-hmm. They'd have a field day. I mean, I had an indoor outdoor cat for a while years ago who would constantly bring little mice trophy, you know, serial killer slayings kind of and leave them at my doorstep. So I know their game for a little mice eradication. It'd be an absolute field day. I do want to point out, too, that like this is a several fold problem because obviously these creatures can cause the spread of disease. Mm-hmm. And they are a self replicating system, obviously, because they breed insanely. Apparently female mice can breed from 6 weeks old and give birth to 50 baby mice or pups a single year. So, you know, multiply that with the thousands already in existence. That's absolutely staggering.
Yeah. And it's also cyclical, right? From what I understand, this plague returns around every 4 years or so. And, you know, I know the mice are definitely the quote unquote bad guy antagonist in this situation, but they're just doing what they have evolved to do. And I guarantee you, when the population reaches this kind of density, the mice are miserable too.
Right? Of course they are.
Resources are in short supply. A lot of them are going to be living very short, very brutal lives. But still, the disease vector is the main thing for the humans involved. And then this is expensive. We're talking millions and millions of dollars of damage.
It's true. Damage to crops, to property. We're talking about like bales of hay even that are being infested by these mice. And, you know, they're urinating and pooping in the bales of hay. And there was some figure that it's cost the farming industry several millions of dollars already just in bales of hay that have to be destroyed, because you can't feed, you know, shitty hay to cows because it would kill them or it would make them very sick. Right. So it's interesting, actually, Ben, to your point about disease, that has not been any of the reporting that I've seen. So I don't know if that's something that just requires a longer timeline to be able to attribute or to track, but God, hoping for that cold snap, man. This story is only about 3 or 4 days old in terms of the press cycle, press coverage. But like we say, it's been going on there, you know, since October. So that is just wild stuff. I don't know. It's pretty scary.
You definitely have to watch out for lymphocytic? I think it's lymphocytic chorioamnionitis or something like that. It's a form of meningitis that can be spread by these guys.
But it's very rare. Mm-hmm. And also the symptoms that are described in a Guardian article quoting Priscilla Stanley from the local health district. The symptoms are like WebMD level. Discomforting and vague. One of the symptoms that Stanley points out is sore red eyes. I hate when we're reporting this because it is a symptom, but for anybody who just had a panicked look in the mirror, I promise you, it's probably not related to a mice plague if you have sore red eyes. There are any number of other things that could explain that.
Mostly pink eye.
Or a lack of sleep.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Guys, can you imagine the extraterrestrial, highly intelligent species version of this conversation about humans?
Oh, yes. I was just thinking about that.
They can breed. They can replicate one or two more every 8 to 9 months. Mm-hmm. They just take over everything. There's the resources.
They're filthy. They spread diseases. They ruin every ecosystem they interact with. Well, it's funny you mention that, Matt, because we were talking a little bit off air. I think we've mentioned this on the show before, but there's a sci-fi author named Adrian Tchaikovsky that I got really into recently, who does, without spoiling his work, he has these fantastic novels that explore what would happen if there were if another life form evolved to fill the ecological niche of humanity, right? They became sentient, the ravens, the corvids, the octopuses, and so on. And there is one, I believe it's in the Doors of Eden, but there's one exploration of what would happen to the planet had a rodent-like creature evolved to become the quote-unquote human. And it's disastrous because of the overpopulation. But I am sure. Wouldn't you consider humans a plague if you were an extraterrestrial creature and you saw them, you know, heading to your moon on Jupiter or whatever? And be like, these guys are bad news.
Totally. And I mean, humans are much more calculatedly bad news. The mice, it's hard to blame them for just their biological imperative, right? I mean, humans make some pretty dumb decisions and should know better, You know what I mean? I'm with you. And this is the kind of thing, too, where it's like, I'd be fascinated to know what the very extreme animal rights folks think about this. Would their position be, no, you can't kill the mice, you know, let them do their thing? Or would they even kind of understand that there was more at stake here than the lives of the little guys?
That is weird. Each one is a living thing that feels.
It's funny. I've been rewatching 6 Feet Under. Really, really special, wonderful show if anyone hasn't checked it out. But this isn't a spoiler. It's just a character that comes up in a later season, played by Rainn Wilson, friend of the podcast or the network. What's it? Terry Carnation, right? Isn't that this character on Radio Rental? He plays an apprentice that joins the Fishers in their funeral home business, Fisher and Sons, and he and Ruth, the mother, kind of hit it off. And one of the ways they initially hit it off is they both say the same thing about, well, we love all living things, but mice deserve to die because they carry germs.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, poor guys. I mean, from what I understand, these plagues tend to subside with the seasons, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the cold weather earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And that's certainly what the government is. I don't know. I mean, I understand that there's hard decisions you have to make when you're a leader. You have to make the calculation of, like, is it worth it to spend the resources to, you know, quell this thing now that only affects a certain portion of the population when we think or are pretty confident that something natural is going to come along and fix it without having to spend a dime? Or are you essentially being cruel and subjecting your citizens to a hellish existence by not stepping in? I don't know the answer to that. It seems to me a little irresponsible because who knows when that cold snap will come. And who know, you know, given the weirdness of weather and who knows when that super rainy season that would be required will come given the drought conditions. So I don't know. It seems pretty irresponsible to me. Well, with that relatively bleak story, which we'll absolutely keep an eye on, we're going to hop to another commercial break, and then we'll be back with one more piece of strange news.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent, telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back. I wonder if you can see me. Can you see me? Hello.
Well, it looks like
this
a wormhole.
This is a video effect of Matt going through the wormhole. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm done with
that's
that.
That's pretty
now.
Cool. No, this is definitely going to be the YouTube clip.
I'm trying to give Doc Holliday ideas for more music videos. We've already got something working with Taco Bell and what's the name of that thing we're discussing that's no longer there? The
Cheesy Fiesta Potatoes. A lot of good menu items died. And
the Mexican pizza, I believe Doc's favorite was the Mexi Melt, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Mexi Melt is gone.
We just got that in the chat. I just want to say the Cheesy Fiesta Potatoes came back. So there's hope yet for these extinct menu items.
Oh, man. And they've still got that Chalupa Supreme. That's my all-time favorite. Actually, no, the Gordita Supreme was my favorite.
I love the confidence. You know what I mean? The chutzpah to put Supreme in the title of this stuff. You know what I mean?
It's just sour cream, man. It's sour Supreme and some salsa and stuff. Okay, so we are going to talk a little bit about Epstein today, and we mentioned it at the top of this right. A little bit. We're not going to do that today. We're going to talk about that later. But what we are going to talk about is one specific instance of what happens when one person decides not to leave a house. We've mentioned this before on the show a couple of times. I'm trying to think of the full context in which we've discussed it, but the concept of evictions and the rights that an individual or group has when they are living in a place. And now it changes a lot over, especially in the United States, it changes on a state-by-state basis. Mm-hmm. There are some rules that apply overall, but most of it is it's going to be handled in whichever state you're living in. Now, I'm going to read a story to you from Fox 2 Detroit. This is the headline. Couple buys Riverside Dream Home, but seller refuses to move out in eviction moratorium loophole. So the concept here is that, I'll just give it to you, the overall thing. Man 1 owns a $560,000 house. It's a big, really nice $500,000 house. He calls up a real estate agent and says, hey, man, I really need to sell my home really quickly. It needs to be at least $560,000 and I need to sell it in like 2 weeks. Let's do this. So real estate agent and man number one put out, you know, an ad as you do, or here's the information on this house. We need it sold quickly. On the other side, you've got a younger couple that are trying to purchase a home. They identify this home. They realize that it's worth more than that amount of money on the market. So they think, oh, this is a great deal. We're going to buy this house. We're going to scrap together all the money, get some loans, make it happen right now. Let's do this. That was in January of 2020, I believe, when that occurred. January 31st. That is the purchase date of the home. That is when $560,000 went into the bank account of person one. The guy who owned the house and was living in the house. Now, that occurs, and usually there's a contract if you're buying or selling a home, if you're renting, you're moving, anything like that. There's a contract that says when you are allowed to move in to this new purchase or this newly rented, newly leased home. In this case, that date came And it went because when the couple arrived there to try and take over the new property, the man just decided he wasn't going to leave. Hey. He says, yeah, I know you paid for this house and transferred all of these documents to you. It's all legal. It's all written out. Everybody's got it. The banks are involved. Everybody knows there's a legal purchase here, but I'm not leaving. And there's a bit of weirdness occurring here because this was in early January of 2020. And we all remember that a couple of months from that point, just like I think around a month and a half from that point, we all realized as a world that there was a pandemic going on and nobody could really leave their homes at all. I don't see in this reporting exactly how that came into play here, at least from a timeline standpoint, but it is very, very odd to imagine that this could happen and like a sheriff or a police officer wouldn't be able to go to the house, do the police knock on the door, and Ooh. Then just say, get out. This is not your house. Leave. And apparently that will not occur.
Is it because of squatters' rights or something? I don't understand. Why can't they do that? Like, you know, people get evicted all the time. People's stuff gets thrown out into yards if they miss a rent payment.
They're saying, I mean, it's weird. Like here's a quote from the article from an eviction attorney named Dennis Block. He says, this person is not a tenant. It's a previous owner who is enjoying the benefits of the money that was transferred to his account, but he doesn't want to move out of the premises that he no longer owns. He's like, just saying like, that's what's going on here.
Right.
So according to what's been written up here in this article, they're saying that they closed the escrow in January 2020 and they've contacted authorities. They've been attempting for a long time now to get this person out, but they've gotten nowhere. And they're saying it's like a COVID tenant situation. The concept where there's been a moratorium on evictions, right? In a lot of places, and rightly so, it's been made much more difficult to evict someone from a home. If you are the landowner and someone is renting that property, you can't just kick someone on the street because people are having problems making rent payments right now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people are having trouble doing that. Mm-hmm. Watch John Oliver. He's got a whole special on it. You can learn all about it. But in this case, that is not at all the situation. And it appears that that's what is occurring here.
So it's kind of like, just for a comparison, it's... Well, there are two comparisons. I don't know which is helpful, but the easiest one is, let's say you sell someone a car and you say, thanks for the cash, and you drive away in the car you sold them, right? And you still use the car and you just refuse to hand over the keys. The other less helpful comparison I would make, just because I enjoy it, is let's say you go to Taco Bell and you pay for a Mexi Melt. And the person you pay takes the money and then starts to eat it in front of you. That's
well, that's just cruel. Yeah, that's inhumane.
And it seems like in this case, this person doesn't fall under some of those loopholes, because it's not as if they are financially unable to acquire other accommodation, right? Like they were paid house level money, which lets you do some pretty big moves if you wish.
Yeah.
I don't understand why that person, like, I, you're right, squatter rules, as they're commonly called, I don't know how they would apply, because some states have a baked in statute, right? A time limit. Like if you are squatting on an abandoned property for insert number of years here, then you become considered like a legal occupant, or there's a path to that. But, you know, and I want to be very careful, Matt, not to ascribe motive if I'm just guessing, or to call this person a terrible person if we don't know their circumstances, right? There may be some compelling issue. Right?
Yeah, we have no idea what this situation is. Again, this is like a little Fox report on this about A person who sold a home and won't leave.
Friend of the show, Peyton Fisher, who I believe you've all met, is an eviction attorney in Brooklyn, New York. And he has some very interesting and colorful casts of characters and scenarios of all varieties that, you know, cross different kind of like extra legal kind of areas sometimes. So I would be interested to get his take on this. You know, because it is such an interesting gray area. I wonder if he's ever even heard of this, this idea.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely a weird situation. What I would just, this is what I would say. And maybe you guys will like this very much. I think there needs to be a company, like a private company that is kind of like a towing company. You know, these towing companies that will find out there's a car that's overdue or something on the payments for like 3 months. They can't locate the vehicle, but then they have essentially a private investigator track down the vehicle and a tow truck will go out and get it.
A repo company. Oh, right.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining in one word what I was trying to say.
Made famous by Emilio Estevez.
That's right. Repo Man. The weird, it's a very genre kind of a B movie, Repo Man. Very strange, but a classic. Interesting stuff.
Well, and let's not forget the genetic opera. But but what I'm saying is there needs to be a company that is like that, but for like a lawful, like an eviction where someone just won't leave, where they've got elaborate ruses, where somebody comes to the front door and, you know, puts on a show of some sort to get them outside of the home. Then another person like sneaks out and like, you know, gets them out of the house, then locks the door and then changes the locks really fast.
Oh, there's potential for it because the, how do we say this carefully? From what I understand, the legal owner of this house went and tried to fix the yard. And then the dude ran out and tore up the sprinklers or the sprinkler line they had set down. So this is definitely a get off my lawn type of dude. So just get on the lawn.
Get on the lawn, bait him out like the mice.
Yeah.
Then lock him in a place where he can't see for 40 days. And you've got a full episode of stuff they don't want you to know.
You know, I have to say, one thing that really stood out to me in this, man, is that the eviction attorney you mentioned, Dennis Block, says it's not unique, that there have been almost 10 other examples of this. But at the risk of sounding unempathetic, it feels like the most important thing to remember here is that these eviction moratoriums were written in a hurry. And they're very much necessary for a huge part of the U.S. population. But this is very clearly not the spirit of the law as it was intended. And I don't think you have to have graduated from Harvard or something to clock that. The people who bought the home went all in. You know what I mean? This is, they did not, as they say in Gattaca, save anything for the swim back. And the person who is, to add insult to injury, petty insult to injury, apparently the person who is continuing to live in the home they sold, they're not taking care of it. So imagine you spent you have saved for years and years and years, and you've basically paid for a very expensive piece of sadistic performance art where somebody makes you watch them ruin your Mexi melt. Like this is, and you paid much more than you would.
And you just paid $500,000 for that Mexi melt.
Yeah, I want to know more about this person. Sounds like a bit of a sociopath.
Well, and who knows? Again, who knows what's going on there?
Right.
But again, I'm ready to start that company if anybody out there listening wants to. And I will, if you're a heavy, like you, whoever you are, you'd have to play the heavy probably, but I can dance around on a lawn, make a nuisance. I can play that other part. You just let me know.
What about, you've heard of improv everywhere, right? They'd be perfect for this. Yeah. That's who I would contact. Just to immediately, Improv Everywhere is a really fun and smart, optimistic, approach to the generation of fake crowds. And it's very, like, it is incredibly easy to do. So you can, you know, don't think of it like a government manufacturing a protest. It's much easier than that. All you have to do is, like, get on the right forum, tell people to show up. If you, it depends on how honest you want to be with the people, too, in this company, Matt. Like, you could just say you're casting extras for a film. That's what one bank robber did, something like that. Cast extras, had everybody show up in the same costume as the bank robber was wearing, and then just poof, Kaiser Soze into the crowd. Brilliant. Don't do it. I can't legally co-sign that. But yeah, this is a serious problem. Like Noel, I want to know more about the person in that house. Is there a reason that they cannot leave? You know, I mean, I imagine they're spending that money on something, right? There was a $30,000 tax lien on the property, but are they like, is there perhaps some sort of physical or medical condition, right? And I don't know.
I was wondering that too, yeah. Ben. That's a really good point. Perhaps the person is unable to leave for some reason, and it's not just a willful disregard for the contract that they entered into, which apparently isn't as ironclad as one might think. I did pass this on to friend of the show and tenant lawyer Peyton Fisher, and hopefully we'll have some word back by the next episode. Perhaps we can do a follow-up.
All right, sounds good. Well, that's it from me, guys. If you liked any of the stories we talked about today and you want to discuss them further, you want to add your own personal experience and just get us up to speed to where you are, you can reach out to us. You can find us anywhere. We are all over social media. On Twitter and Facebook, we are Conspiracy Stuff. And on Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. On Facebook, you can find Here's Where It Gets Crazy. That's our show page, which, by the way, guys, we've been getting an increased number of these fake Facebook notifications about our page and violations.
Sure.
Just watch out.
To the real ones.
Oh, yeah. About content being removed? Those aren't real?
No.
Yeah. It's about shutting down. You got to shut down and all this stuff. Click on a link. Be careful out there if you're getting those too. It's not real. And, at least most of them.
And if you say, well, that is a great argument for not using social media in general, right? I spend my deep time differently. Then you can give us a call. Tell us about mice plagues. Tell us about other plagues. Tell us what you think. We should do an episode on squatter rights. I think that's fascinating. And tell us whether you would participate in a crazy deep time isolation experiment. You can tell us directly. Just call us. It's 1-833-STDWYTK. You have 3 minutes. They belong to you. Do with them as you will. We do like to recommend, if you're like kind of stumbling and get stressed about that 3 minute time limit, we do have a helpful structure. Tell us your name or nickname you prefer, whether we can use your name on air. Tell us what's on your mind. If there's something you want to just send to us personally, that's fine. Save that for the end. Most importantly, if 3 minutes is not enough time, do not edit. Do not censor yourself. Write to us and tell us the whole story. You can do that very easily via our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.